From The Lens, the New Orleans area's first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom dedicated to unique investigative and explanatory journalism, this is Behind the Lens. I'm Carolyn Heldman. On this episode, criminal justice reporter Nick Krastel will get us up to date on a man who's serving a life sentence for attempting to steal a pair of hedge clippers in 1997. He was just granted a new parole hearing after his appeal to the state Supreme Court to review his case was denied. We'll also talk to education reporter Marta Jewson about kids in special education in the New Orleans school system. They often receive one-on-one time with teachers and therapists. How does that work when school is online only? Marta and I also talked to Faymon Roberts of the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, on the abrupt announcement from Jefferson Parish School District to delay the opening of schools there by another 2 weeks. And a landlord in Algiers continues to flout the legal system with eviction notices on some of his tenants' doors. Are we on the verge of a wave of evictions in New Orleans? Michael Isaac Stein will give us the details on that story. And editor at The Lens, Charles Maldonado, is also joining in on the discussion today. Okay, let's get to the news. Nick, big story happened yesterday even. Tell us, who is Fair Wayne Bryant and what is his story?
So, Fair Wayne Bryant was a man convicted in 1997 for stealing a pair of hedge clippers in Caddo Parish, Louisiana. And he received a life sentence for that conviction under what is known as a multiple offender bill. Just two weeks ago, Friday, July 31st, the Supreme Court denied an appeal to hear his case. The decision not to hear his case came down on a Friday, and that weekend I noticed some attorneys who follow the Supreme Court's happenings much closer than I do passing around a decision written by a dissent written by one of the justices on social media, which was interesting to me. So I looked into it and read the full dissent and started working on a story.
How close was the decision?
Not close. Five of the seven justices voted not to review the case. One recused, and then the Chief Justice, Burnett Johnson, was the only one who said she would have reviewed it and was the only one who issued a full opinion on that.
What did her opinion say?
So her opinion was really interesting. Not only did she write that she would have reviewed Bryant's sentence, which she called excessive, and said that it served no penal purpose to be holding someone for life in prison for attempting to steal a pair of hedge clippers. She also really attacked the law that Bryant was convicted under, the habitual offender law, which allows prosecutors to seek much tougher sentences for crimes that normally wouldn't warrant them if the person has had previous felonies. So she called the habitual offender law the modern manifestation of laws that were enacted after Reconstruction that, as she put it, were used largely to re-enslave African Americans.
Yesterday, he was granted another parole hearing.
His case has now gained a significant amount of attention, and he had already had this administrative hearing scheduled for yesterday to determine whether or not he would get another parole hearing. He's been up for parole three times already since 2015 and has been denied all those times.
Do you know the details of those denials?
I know what the executive director of the Pardons and Parole Board has told me, which is limited, but basically he pointed to his behavioral conduct in prison. So he had apparently a number of write-ups, and then there's been apparently opposition from law enforcement.
Is there any reason to believe that this time will be different? Just the momentum or the public sentiment moving in his favor?
I think that certainly could have an effect. Also, Bryant apparently has not had a disciplinary infraction since 2018. So I think that should likely improve his chances. It's hard to say, and we won't know. His hearing is scheduled on October 15th, so we won't know until then.
Is there a history of any of these offenders being released? People who've been punished under this particular law?
Some people who are punished under this law don't receive life sentences, but even those who do are often eligible for parole. Even people who are sentenced to life without parole often end up being eligible for parole under a certain set of circumstances, both depending on the type of their offense and their age and how much of their sentence they've served. So yes, people do get released. I think critics of the law would say they're still serving too much time for the crime that they've done.
Do you have any insight into how often she disagrees with the rest of the court? I mean, she's the Chief Justice. I'm wondering how often she's on a lone voice on one side of an issue.
I don't know, but it should be noted that she's the only Black person on the court and the only woman on the court currently. And about a month ago, when the George Floyd protests were really sort of taking off, she wrote a letter to all the judges throughout the state, sort of encouraging them to take a more critical look at the ways in which the judiciary in Louisiana has sort of enacted laws that have had racist impacts, basically. Mm. How these race-neutral laws have sort of perpetuated injustices and racial injustices throughout the state. So this is something that at least very recently, she's been sort of looking at and encouraging other judges and justices to look at.
Thanks, Nick. The next big topic is education, and Marta, who's been digging into the special education system in the New Orleans schools, which is particularly difficult for their families because those kids often have one-on-one time with both teachers and therapists. So there's obviously some complications to do that virtually.
We just wanted to take a look, right, like you said, how that's happening for students. And, you know, since we have so many different networks of charter schools, that's going to be different across the board. We talked to one family that basically said that their services stopped in the spring and that, you know, they're hoping to get them started up now. I think schools are really looking at, you know, can we have a speech therapist or an occupational therapist push into a normal class if that student is in the normal class. We also have schools that are delivering like literal supplies, like, you know, balls and other tactile objects that someone might use in an occupational therapy class. So really a range of solutions that people are working towards.
Did the parents feel like in the spring they just sort of were not thought of at all and now they're starting to address it?
I think one parent I talked to, Robbie Chavez at Bricolage, he didn't think that they necessarily weren't considered at all. I think it was more, they understood it was a time of panic, and obviously we haven't been in this situation in our generation at all. But, you know, he's really very thankful for educators and everything they're doing. However, he's really hoping that they can kind of get it together now that we're in this for what appears to be the foreseeable future.
What's he in particular worried about?
He's got two boys in first grade or now second grade. The boys also took part in something that's available for students with special needs called the Extended School Year Program. So they can basically take summer courses. And he said he just really had hoped to see, you know, more communication about that program, how that would work. And he's feeling similarly right now. You know, they're going into school in about a week and he's still kind of looking for details on how therapies will be provided and what specifically that's going to look like.
He has a long history of sort of advocating for special needs students at his school and throughout the system. There was a group that he was sort of instrumental in forming up last year, was it, Marta? The Sunshine Parents?
Yeah, and he formed that group just to bring more transparency and accountability for special education services in schools throughout the city. So yeah, he's been a very vocal driver of special education advocacy.
Obviously, there's a myriad of issues, right? And they all need a myriad of solutions. Some parents are expressing that homeschooling has been an improvement for their kids. Did you talk to any parents about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we know that special education is really a broad range and a broad spectrum, from children who need someone literally next to them the entire day to children who might just have like a sensory disorder or an attention deficit problem. And so I think for kids with any sensory disorders, their behavioral disorders, and also, of course, like perhaps anxiety, this actually might be a boon for them because they are able to stay at home in a controlled environment or mostly controlled environment But that parent I spoke with who said that her son with anxiety and behavioral issues, you know, who on occasion would drop to the floor in a hallway of a classroom, which is certainly something that would be worrisome right now, as it's worrisome any time in a school, you know, if a fire drill had been occurring. But I think it's especially concerning during COVID. So she said that she thinks her son, this has been absolutely a success story for him being able to stay at home. But, you know, she did point out that she's able to stay at home with him all day. So what about parents who can't? So I think that's one of the big questions there. I talked to the school director at Opportunities Academy, which serves students ages 18 to 22, because if you have special education needs, you're allowed to get services until you're 22 in the public system. Her name is Sophia Scott. And she said that, you know, over the summer, they were able to develop videos and other ways that they could work, have those lessons online that parents could then go through with their students at whatever time was convenient for them. And they could then send those recorded lessons back so teachers could give input. You know, she said going into this fall, this is really going to be their fourth iteration of virtual learning. And they think with time, they've really improved.
And I'm guessing that they're going to have to adjust even more when school goes back to in-person schooling. It's going to be particularly fraught with some special ed kids.
Right. I think if you think about some students with low incidence behavioral disorders or other issues, that is going to be a real challenge. Distancing could be a challenge. And I think for other students, just, you know, students who may have not displayed tendencies in the past, like there's a lot of anxiety right now. So maybe even students who haven't been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder or something like that. This is a lot for everybody.
Indeed. Thanks, Marta. Faymon Roberts of the Times-Picayune New Orleans Advocate here to talk about this giant school system, Jefferson Parish, which just announced on Monday, giving 2 days notice that they were delaying the opening of schools for 2 weeks. Why the delay?
So I think there's a couple of things at play here. The stated reason from Superintendent James Gray, who it should be noted has been on the job for about 1 month, if even that. I don't think he's been officially on the job for a month yet. So that the school system was delaying in order to have rapid testing available for all symptomatic faculty and staff from day one. So that was their stated reason for the delay. There had been pressure. I think parents had expressed concerns. Certainly faculty had expressed concerns about their plans to go back to school. But that was the stated reason.
How confident is everyone in this timeline that 2 weeks is enough time to get that in place?
I think the school system's confidence in that comes from what Ochsner is telling them that they will have available for them. They are working closely with Ochsner. I don't think that confidence is universally shared amongst employees and parents, that even if they do have it in place, whether it will be enough to stem new outbreaks of COVID-19.
Are parents and teachers organized at all in their opposition to this timeline, or is it just random voices?
So this is an interesting question. Yes, teachers specifically are definitely organized. And the union, the Jefferson Federation of Teachers, presented to the administration a long list of questions. And I mean long. It was 165 questions long a couple of weeks ago before the reopening. And they said, these are the questions we have going into the start of school, and we'd like to work together. And the questions ranged from everything like, are we going to have enough hand sanitizer, to have you inspected the air circulation in the buildings to make sure that it is safe for us, and things like this. Well, after the teachers went back to school on August the 3rd, I think was the first day for teachers, the union had more questions that they were presenting to the school system. But apart from the union, groups of teachers have lodged a couple of highly visible protests outside the school board meeting. They've been attended by anywhere from a couple of dozen to a couple of, maybe a little bit more than 100, but certainly made for dramatic pictures of dozens of people standing outside holding up signs. So it's hard to say to what extent that really played a role. Parent opposition, I think, is tougher to gauge. There has been some chatter on some of the social media, of course, as there always is. I think perhaps the best data indicator of parent concern is that between 18 and 19,000 students have signed up for the system's all virtual offering this year. So you're looking at almost 40% of the district students have signed up to just do online learning. And so obviously I think that's a significant amount of parent concern about the district's reopening plans.
My guess would be that a great percentage of those who are choosing to keep their kids home have the ability to financially, the resources. Do you think that the way they're going to approach it is going to exacerbate existing disparities?
I think both virtual and in-person can exacerbate disparities. So it depends on obviously what your needs are. They can exacerbate health disparities if you're in a class versus not in a class, or learning disparities if you're in a class or not in a class. And you're right, it can bring out who does have access to internet or the ability to stay at home, or who's an essential worker and needs their child to be supervised by someone. And then the way that having more people stay home actually kind of helps in a situation, I think some districts might be relying on this, is then that you're going to see class sizes drop, and so more students can be going into the classroom depending on how many students are not coming into the classroom. That's kind of a funny way to phrase it, but I think we're probably seeing that in multiple parishes.
Yeah, I think especially depending on the quality of the virtual offering, I think that's a big variable here that we don't know the answer to. I think that any radical change, especially any sudden radical change to a paradigm as sort of social service driven like education, can certainly exacerbate the disparities in the qualities of education received by students. And you're right that the students, if it is the students at home who are able to stay at home because they have a parent at home, because only one parent in the house has to work, or because those parents are not necessarily deemed essential workers who have to be outside of the house, and because their students are at home, they have great technology and internet access, then I think it could benefit the students who go to school in educational terms. Now, in health terms, that's a whole other question that is going to be addressed. Regardless of what your economic situation is, if you're in grade 6 through 12, you're going to be doing 3 days per week virtually anyway. Under the Jefferson Parish plan. They've also been procuring hotspots, and I know these are similar things to what's been going on in Orleans Parish, procuring hotspots and low-cost internet connection options in an attempt to address some of those disparities. I don't know if it'll be successful or not, but they have at least acknowledged those. And Jefferson Parish has the added complication of being an extraordinarily diverse district. They have to produce all their literature in 4 languages, English, Spanish, Arabic, and Vietnamese.
Wow.
It's going to be an interesting year for them.
Probably like Orleans Parish is, I don't want to say they're excited other districts are going back before them, but there's going to be a lot to learn from other districts that have already gone back, even in these 2 weeks for both Jefferson and Orleans when they do go back.
It's a real-time experiment in epidemiology. On education. Feynman, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, no problem.
And a late-breaking update reported early Friday the 14th by Feynman Roberts and Ramon Antonio Vargas from the Times-Picayune. Discovery Schools, a 2,400-student charter school network in Jefferson Parish, has opted to shut all the system's campuses down until September 11th due to positive coronavirus tests. The announcement came in an email that was sent to parents late Thursday night. You're listening to Behind the Lens. I'm Carolyn Heldman. My guests this week, Nick Krastel, Marta Jusen, Michael Isaac Stein, and Lens editor Charles Maldonado. We're also speaking to special guest Feynman Roberts III, a staff writer at the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate.
Hi, I'm Ann Muller, Chief Operating Officer at The Lens. The Lens is the New Orleans area's first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom, dedicated to unique investigative and explanatory journalism. We have a diverse set of financial supporters, including major national foundations, local foundations, and dedicated readers in the New Orleans area. Please make a tax-deductible donation to support our work at thelensnola.org/donate. Thank you.
Our last story for this week Michael, tell us about Josh Bruno.
Josh Bruno is a landlord who owns several businesses in the city, and he's been in the news a couple times since the pandemic began. We're kind of picking off on some reporting that the Times-Picayune did earlier in the pandemic. A couple times in the spring when Bruno issued eviction notices to some of his tenants, that kind of went against, you know, what state moratoriums and federal moratoriums existed on evictions. So this latest round was at the end of July. He sent out these notices to what we were told was roughly 20 apartments in this apartment building he owns on the West Bank called Cypress Park Apartments. And they basically just said, you have 3 days to either pay what you owe or to vacate the apartment. Now, we were alerted to it by attorney Hannah Adams with the Southeast Louisiana Legal Services. And basically, she was pointing out that the units in this apartment building should be covered by certain eviction protections that exist in the Federal CARES Act. So in the CARES Act, there was a moratorium put on evictions for certain properties that engaged with, you know, a wide range of federal programs, one of them being Section 8 vouchers. And this apartment building does house some Section 8 voucher units. So the argument here was that this apartment building would apply to the moratorium. But on top of the moratorium, there's also a requirement that landlords of these properties provide 30 days notice to tenants, not just, you know, 1 or 3 days notice. So the claim here was that these eviction notices were issued in violation of that federal act.
Because even if all the tenants in that building aren't under Section 8, they're a blanket protection could be enacted.
Yeah, and so that's what Hannah Adams argues. I think it's interesting because it's so new, this act, you know, that, you know, a lot of times after, you know, Congress writes a law, you don't really know what it means until it's been litigated, until, you know, lawyers start arguing about, you know, the definitions of certain words or phrases. So there's definitely a lot of question marks, you know, into what these protections mean. I'd say I actually think, you know, one of the more interesting question marks on these protections, you know, that we got into a little bit was that, you know, the moratorium for these units ended July 24th. Now that has a clear expiration date, but what Hannah Adams was arguing is that the requirement to give 30 days notice actually doesn't have an expiration date in the law. So, you know, what she was saying, what could have long-term implications here is that it's possible that that 30-day notice requirement could be, you know, here to stay in perpetuity. Units that fall into the CARES Act, which is a significant amount of, you know, residential units in the city, you know, will always have to give 30 days notice, which would be a big change from what exists right now.
What's the notice requirement right now under state or city law? Is it 3 days?
I believe 5 days notice in state law, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Michael?
Well, I thought it was, I mean, when it's a court eviction, I know that when a court eviction is ordered, those go, you know, when I've sat in, those have usually gone in 48 hours. Usually it's, okay, we're going to send out someone tomorrow, and then you'll have 24 hours from that notice to vacate.
That's once a judge has handed down an order, but I believe the notice from your landlord is a 5-day requirement.
That sounds right.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that it was this company, Metrowide, which they have a couple of apartment complexes over on the West Bank by the school district headquarters, and the Cypress Park included. But on the other side is this like giant overgrown lot that I pass every time I go to a school board meeting. There's this giant sign, Metrowide Apartments coming soon. And it is overgrown to the point now where you can barely see this sign. And I know the storm changed a lot of things, but when I think about Metrowide, that is like this image that I have.
So Metrowide has definitely gotten some bad press throughout the pandemic. But, you know, I think the other, you know, as long as we're talking about the difference between, you know, a court-ordered eviction and, you know, more informal evictions that happen outside of a court, I think that's where Housing advocates and attorneys are really worried, you know, about the long-term implications of the 30-day notice, because again, it's unclear if there's any, you know, consequences that Bruno or Metrowide could face for issuing notices like this. That's just, you know, from the lawyers I've spoken to, not clear in the CARES Act, you know. And at the same time, if a tenant sees this notice, even if it wouldn't hold up in court, if they get scared and they leave, there's not a lot of legal recourse after that to get them back in their homes. So, you know, I think the issue here is one of, I guess, getting that information out to tenants, you know, especially again, if this 30-day notice requirement is here to stay, getting that information out to tenants and also giving tenants the tools to know, you know, if they actually live in a building that applies under the CARES Act is important as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always a big concern for people who advocate for tenants is, you know, that just a lot of people are not going to know the law. They're not going to know that notice is required, that a particular procedure is required. Now you throw in a whole new set of things that people aren't necessarily aware of with the CARES Act. So, you know, as Michael mentioned, I think fair to say that there are a large but unknown number of what would probably, you know, what could be called either informal or illegal evictions happening. And we'll just, you know, and all that we can really gather for records on, and we haven't really done this work, but certain groups, notably the Jane Place Neighborhood Sustainability Initiative, has gathered some statistics on that in the past and shown that, you know, formal evictions have affected a large chunk of the city. So informal evictions, we have no way of knowing.
And to speak to that, I mean, it took me a good amount of time to figure out if this, you know, if Cypress Park Apartments actually applied under the CARES Act. That took me a few days to, you know, get through to the right people. And again, I'm pretty good at finding information, and, you know, I have all day to do it because it's my job. It's not a simple thing for, you know, just any resident to go through, for sure.
If it's up to a government source somehow to be the mechanism by which someone is evicted, you would think the onus would be on them to find out if it's an legal act or not to evict that person.
Yeah. So they are relying in part right now on the landlords who are required to submit these affidavits, you know, attesting to their contention that their property is not covered by CARES Act restrictions. What's less clear is, you know, how much, you know, due diligence the courts are doing to actually verify the accuracy of those affidavits, especially when someone, a tenant hasn't sought out legal services from a group like Southeast Louisiana Legal Services. As far as the law enforcement side, if I'm correct, in first and second city courts, which are the main eviction courts, is carried out by the constable's offices. They're the ones who actually execute the evictions, and their role is not really researching the legality of these evictions. It's simply carrying out the court's orders.
Mm. Tell me about, though, the kind of overarching status of evictions and affordability in this city before COVID-19 happened, and does this presage a wave?
Off the bat, I'll start, you know, again by saying, because so many of, you know, the city's evictions happen outside of a court, it's really hard to gauge numbers on, you know, the full picture. But, you know, coming into coronavirus, you know, the city has, you know, obviously has long had a housing affordability crisis. It's something that I think over the last 5-10 years has gone from something that advocates argued to crisis being a pretty well accepted fact among elected officials and government officials in general. As for evictions, like I said, it's hard to track. Jane Place had done a study, actually, I think that was February, right before the coronavirus hit, that, you know, went through court evictions and found that we had, you know, twice the rate of the national average for the number of residents per capita going through court evictions or having a court eviction issued against them. So going into the pandemic, we were already fairly vulnerable from a housing perspective, I'd say. And obviously, this has just made things even more difficult.
Just when we're thinking about housing shortages in New Orleans, I think it's been really interesting to see we've had these moratoriums on certain parts of short-term rentals, and those have been emptying out, right? So now we're seeing these month by month or 5 to 6 month leases out there that are available, and that is kind of really showing, like what Michael said, this housing shortage that has kind of slowly accumulated, and now these empty apartments.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've definitely been seeing a lot of postings for, you know, fully furnished apartments that look like Airbnbs, looking for month-to-month leases, you know, kind of waiting the storm out till they can start renting again. I think the connection between short-term rentals and affordable housing is fairly clear, but I mean, I think the issue overall is there's just a lot of different factors coming together to make things difficult. I'll have one more thing. I talked to Martha Kegel yesterday for a different story. She is the director of Unity, which is the city's leading homeless services provider. We were talking about a few different things, but she, from a homelessness perspective, is extremely concerned about the eviction crisis and kind of wanted to talk about that a lot. You know, we've taken a lot of unsheltered homeless people off the streets in the last 5 months, you know, a lot of them temporarily. But, you know, she was saying it's going to be really hard, you know, to keep those homeless numbers any lower than they were prior to the pandemic. You know, even that, you know, keeping it a little bit lower than it was before the pandemic will be, you know, a Herculean effort. So what that's going to look like in the next few months, we're just going to have to watch and see, I guess.
Right. Thanks, Michael. It's a great story. And thank you, everybody else. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, everyone, and thank you, Carolyn.
This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Thanks to our guests this week, Nick Krastel, Marta Jusen, Michael Isaac Stein, editor Charles Maldonado, and special guest from The Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, Fayman Roberts III. You can read all the week's news along with opinions at our website, thelensnola.org. See you next week.